Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. On Sunday night, that music, it's a selection of our guest, Dr. John Pahl, of the Lutheran Theological Seminary at Philadelphia. John Pahl, welcome to Sunday night.
Thank you very much. Delight to be here.
Great to hear you select Stevie Wonder.
Well, I enjoy Stevie Wonder. He's a preacher in my book.
Superstition, it's an interesting title for a piece of music, but it actually reflects something of what is in your book, that in some ways American culture and the way violence and religion have related to each other in American culture has more to do with sort of primitive religious urges than it does with perhaps our more conventional understandings of what Christianity is and should be.
That's exactly right. There are lots of unexamined religious forces operating in American culture and globally as well. I describe in the book the religion of the market and the way it operates to create sacrificial exchanges that often produce extraordinary concentrations of wealth, but also abject poverty, which kills people just as surely as a gunshot, only more slowly and with greater suffering. And then I also discuss the way militaries and the concentration of weaponry serve symbolic purposes that are also religious at their core. And needless to say, in American history, we've had a few adventures militarily in recent years that have had a devastating effect on the economy, on the environment, and on human life.
We've seen religion used symbolically, particularly throughout the Cold War era, as a means of justifying, of giving a righteous imprimatur to acts of violence. Probably the best examples are Ronald Reagan's speeches in which he co-opted Christianity as a crusade. Mm-hmm. Then you go into George W. Bush and the war in Iraq. This is a continuing strand in America, and for many people there is a certain correctness in this, in that opposing atheistic communism was a legitimate enterprise, both religiously and politically, in that communism represented the antithesis of a democracy, so that there was a legitimate justification in pulling these two threads together to fight this crusade.
No, that is the language that has been used repeatedly. Billy Graham is a great example of that in American history. His rallies in the early late 1940s and early 1950s were called crusades. So that's there. And I'm all for, the defense of human rights, democratic freedoms. But the question is what means we use as human beings. My hypothesis in the book is that religions exist to end violence. As human beings, that's why we created them. They're a way to use symbolic tools to resolve rivalries rather than to resort to brutal methods, clubs. Unfortunately, of course, religions are mobile. Their discourses can be co-opted by various systems of domination and systems of force. And this is what's happened in the civil religion of America. And the problem is, when religions migrate, they don't have layers of accountability or structures of accountability, hierarchies woven into them that can keep them moored to the tradition and its ethics of nonviolence. So the civil religion is the problem. The religion of the market is the problem. These unexamined religions that circulate in the modern world.
The interesting thing about that is that religion always escapes its boundaries. It always escapes its doctrinal formulations. For many people, that's a good thing. You need it to constantly renew the religious tradition. Yet the danger is that in escaping those formulations, those theological interpretations, it becomes whatever the culture wants it to become. Christopher Hitchens, in his assault on Christianity and religion generally, has made the point, as many others in this field do at the moment, it seems to be the popular thread of the atheistic argument, that religion is responsible for wars. The response from Christians and other religions is, no, our theologies don't point to that. But Hitchens is actually arguing about the point you're making, about the role of religion generally in society, independent of the traditions from which those religions spring.
Mm-hmm. Hitchens isn't saying anything that Bertrand Russell didn't say in 1927 in Why I'm Not a Christian. And Bertrand Russell said it far more eloquently and with greater savvy and intelligence, in my humble estimation.
The theme in your book, Empire of Sacrifice, is that in many ways civil religion in America has escaped the traditions which gave rise to the religious impulse in America and have become mixed up with this culture of violence. And in some ways support, reinforce, and ideologically justify the culture of violence. Do you want to give us some examples?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do that. Race is a great example of how that has happened. The institution of slavery in America historically was justified by legitimizing the dichotomy or the dualism of black and white, with white over black.
Black is darkness and evil and
yes,
all of those.
Correct. Yeah, that symbolic process. So race is one example in the way in which the civil religion has operated, and it continues on down to today.
The two areas that we haven't mentioned are gender and the whole area of humanity being sort of needing to be sacrificed at some level. The gender one is very powerful today as well.
Yes, it is, and it has been historically, of course. The construction of power over and against women in the history of patriarchy is a red thread throughout and across our cultures. So violence against women is one, and the consolidation of male power through domination is one of those threads, and it's certainly been the case in American history. And then the second is the consolidation of power over and against sexual minorities. This has been the Karl Rove mythology that has been so powerful in organizing the religious right and motivating participation in the democratic process. And I'm all for participation in the democratic process, but not when it is justified through violence, through scapegoating. The DOMA laws that are currently on the books in 37 states across America do real harm to lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual people by excluding them from the rights that heterosexuals like me can take for granted in American society. That's a form of violence.
How is it that the dominant theological traditions in the United States have surrendered themselves to this?
Well, I would actually disagree with that a little bit. The dominant theological traditions, or the ones with deepest historical roots, have been leading the way toward a more inclusive and pluralist understanding of America. So, for instance, the Anglican or the Episcopal Church in the USA has been way out in front on this. My own tradition, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, has also taken what I think is a very brave and courageous stand to ordain LGBT individuals who are in committed partnerships, and in places where it's legal to do so, to perform marriages. So in some ways here, I see the religious traditions, and that could include Jews and Muslims, and Buddhists and Hindus, who are also aware of this dynamic, may be out front in some ways of the culture and its current conventions. Now, there are some who are also lagging behind and who are also using it as a wedge issue to mobilize religious violence in ways that conform to the cultural convention rather than challenge it on behalf of justice and nonviolence and peace.
You're on Sunday Nights. John Cleary with you. Our guest is John Paul, author of Empire of Sacrifice, a professor at the Lutheran Theological Seminary at Philadelphia in the United States. John Paul, before we get on to some of the deeper theological strands and the way they're linked here, let's talk a little bit about the way in which this culture of violence is used by the media. You mentioned Karl Rove earlier and his way of exploiting sort of sectional and sectarian interests. We've seen over recent months the way in which Fox News has begun to use and promote a very sort of narrow view of America. Glenn Beck is perhaps the best proponent with Fox News, and the way he has deliberately incorporated this popular civil religion into his political discourse, and the horror, almost the obscenity to many, of him staging a rally at the Lincoln Memorial on the day of Martin Luther King's great speech last year. It was pretty shocking. That news went around the world. This is a powerful force. Are there elements here converging, that is, the sort of market media with that populist religious strand, that is going to be an immensely powerful force?
My hope is it's already reached its apex and, in fact, is on the decline. Only time will tell, and it'll depend on people who are engaged in the media in self-critical ways, as you obviously are, and I think Al Jazeera can be another example. NPR and the public radio in the United States, even the mainstream media, when they do their research and do their homework, can challenge these kind of master narratives that are driven by narrow political or market ideologies. I remain hopeful that the professionals can do their work.
There is a whole argument here, though, that Fox News is a good example, that goes to whether or not you are any longer in an arena where you can have master narratives, or you can have views that relate to truth. In some ways, we're getting involved in a circular argument here, a chicken and egg. That is, where is truth and how is it to be found? And the challenge presented by, say, the Fox News model or the MSNBC model on the other side is that news is no longer about facts, it's about polemics. It's about who wins the argument, not what is the issue.
No, that's a great observation, and it certainly indicates an erosion of civility in our discourse. But if you go back and look at the history of the media, just in America, for example, and political reporting, studying political cartoons, it's not like, there was a nostalgic day when everybody was nice to everybody. I mean, it's been pretty brutal throughout our history. So I think we're just more aware of these temptations to incivility as they circulate among us now. Best example here, of course, is Islamophobia, and the way fear of Islam has been stoked to justify the consolidation of power and to promote policies that can do real harm. But
these are polarizing forces, aren't they?
Yeah.
They pull us apart. I mean, MSNBC on the left, Fox on the right, it's not about the issue itself, it's about who wins the argument.
Well, finally, it's also about the debate, and I'm kind of old school Democrat in this regard, that, the debate is the lifeblood of democracy. And here, my friend and colleague Jeff Stott at Princeton has written a fine book, Democracy and Tradition, that develops a pragmatic criterion of truth that doesn't water it down anymore, but really sees it truth as evaluated in the process. That is, truth in democratic terms is how the religious ethics work themselves out in practice so that people don't get harmed, so that there are the opportunities for more to flourish. And this has been the best of the American experiment in voluntarism in religion, that we can bring our diverse and deepest beliefs to bear in public life in the hopes that we shape policy through advocacy and practice. We learn then from one another through the process of discovering what Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who's not an American but has lots of implications for America, calls the dignity of difference, where we robustly engage those differences in debate and then take the best from them.
At heart, that is a debate about the nature of civil society.
That's right.
And civil society is actually shaped and based on a set of shared values.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, shared values that are negotiated and worked out in the process, in the contingencies of history, which is why something like 9/11 becomes such a turning point, and how that narrative gets played out is so crucial. So, for example, the Park 51 debate in New York City, it gives us an opportunity to realize how deeply engaged in religious motivations the construction of sacred spaces in America. The memorial that's being planned for Ground Zero is truly going to be a beautiful and powerful place. A lot of green, the largest artificial waterfalls ever made in history. I mean, it truly is going to be a sacred place. But it's a sacred place to remember the dead. And that's only one kind of sacred place. It's one that tends to be associated with America. Drew Gilpin Faust, Harvard's president, has written a masterful book, This Republic of Suffering, Death in the American Civil War, where she argues that death created the American nation, the modern American nation, through the trauma of the Civil War. But that's not the only kind of sacred place there is. So what's going on over at the Park 51, or the Cordoba House Muslim Community Center, is a sacred place for the living. It's a place where communities can gather and learn about one another and engage in the process. There should be no conflict between the two, in short.
Yet the media have exploited this as a game of polar opposites.
Absolutely.
It's about the right of Christians against the rights of Muslims.
Yeah. And what gets missed is how this World Trade Center site is also a Muslim site. Muslims died in the towers. And so it's when, again, the civil religion goes unexamined and uncritically engaged that we tend to get into problems. Because I think Christians, Muslims, Jews of goodwill can see that finally this place transcends any one narrow tradition and ought to be a place for all. And that's the vitality of the American experiment in that multicultural, multi-religious pluralism, which Australia also, from my limited experience, seems to be doing quite well at.
John Paul, let's talk now about mainstream American religion and its role in the development of this civil religion, which has this sort of violence at the center of it. These things do not spring from nowhere. The origins of America as an exceptionalist culture, as the light on the hill, go back to the Puritans landing at Plymouth Rock. Now, there is a very ordered and theologically coherent culture. What happens?
Yeah. Oh, no, you're right to take it back to the Puritans. In my book, I describe the founding event of this empire of sacrifice as the execution of Mary Dyer on Boston Common in 1660. It was a public hanging of a Quaker for no reason other than she was a Quaker. And the Puritans, who, of course, had been oppressed in England, came over to North America. And as is often the problem when people get secular power, became oppressors themselves, right? So that temptation and trajectory is always there.
And it became oppression through moral.
Correct. Oh, absolutely, yeah. Self-righteousness is always the deepest temptation for people of faith to imagine that our articulation or understanding of the Holy One is encompassing. A good lesson in humility is required, I think, in this regard.
That Puritan ethos did, however, provide a huge power. It helped the New Englanders develop in isolation a commonwealth.
Yeah. No question. There's much to admire in that tradition. I'm an avid reader of the Puritan theologian Jonathan Edwards, who has gotten a bad reputation for his fire and brimstone sermons. But really, at the core of Edwards's teaching is the doctrine of grace, the idea that life is a gift, and that we're fragile. Fallible human beings who need a commonwealth and a community to support and sustain us.
That communitarian view maintained sway in American culture right through into the 1850s, the 1860s. You then have a moment which scholars point to as the Second Great Awakening, the evangelical revival that produces what we'd understand today as contemporary evangelists, people like Charles Grandison Finney,
Absolutely.
Who puts away the old Calvinism
and
moves into an era in which he says, it's not my job to just explain the Bible to you. I've got to convince you to follow Christ. I've got to be the salesman. Yeah.
The right use of the constituted means was Finney's description, and he was a master manipulator of the media, as most revivalists have been.
Now, whether intended or not, you suggest that here is the origins of a dangerous form of individualism when it comes to religion.
Yeah, although, I go back to the roots of my own tradition, Lutheranism. Luther was an advocate for the individual as well in his Christian liberty. It's a strong affirmation of, finding one's individual voice and contributing it. Again, the key differentiation for me is the means that we use. That is, how can we engage our traditions in a way that doesn't create these us-them dualisms, but in fact invites into the conversation robustly with, you know, argument and with, you know, passion, the kind of debate where we reason together with one another. And there are plenty of examples of that in American history as well. The book I'm working on right now is entitled A Coming Religious Peace, and it focuses on those movements that have emerged over the course of the 20th century, really, as interreligious advocacy groups and in America and increasingly now around the globe, who've really transformed societies and cultures, including potentially the United States, away from the kind of militarist, market-driven, imperial religion.
We haven't spent much time on the market here,
yeah.
But I'd just like to pursue one or two other strands, and that is the way in which this combination of a populist civil religion suits the way you market things. And this goes back to Finney too, because Finney could almost be writing the recipe for Willie Loman or the Fuller Brush Salesman.
Amway, etc.
Sure. So there is an evangelical association here with commerce that goes right back to that 1850s moment.
Yeah, very true. Many churches in America are looking more and more like shopping malls, and shopping malls conversely are looking like churches. One of my books is entitled Shopping Malls and Other Sacred Spaces. And it's a critique of precisely that process of selling stuff through constructed gods.
And if you go to Chicago and Willow Creek, there you walk into a shopping mall version of religion in which almost all the costly symbols of religion are removed.
Very true.
Cheap grace is available here. There is no cross here. There is no bleeding sacrificial Jesus, which is at the heart of the season of the year that we are in at the moment. It almost removes the heart of Christianity, and the meaning of sacrifice in theological terms is removed.
Well, sacrifice is, you know, again, a tricky term. I tend not to think of the atonement in sacrificial terms. That is, the death of Christ, to me, is not a sacrifice. It's a tragedy. It's an accident. It's the empire making a really bad mistake, and empires do that. With vicious consequences in human lives. So here you have the revelation of the innocent one, the gift being ignored, exploited, stricken, smitten, and afflicted. Right. So what this opens up for us then is to realize how these domination systems, as Walter Wink calls them, operate, and then to discover the potential of a more gracious, nonviolent future. You know, Bonhoeffer, who you invoked by talking about cheap grace, certainly realized that there were limits to the practice of nonviolence. There are occasions when, in fact, you must respond as a last resort in a situation of extraordinary violence with violence. I'm not advocating pacifism, but I think we can, through our religious traditions, realize the normative quality of nonviolence and peace building and justice. Again, cutting across our traditions, Hinduism, Judaism, Buddhism, Islam, Christianity, the indigenous traditions. If you study their teachings, their central teachings, not the peripheral teachings that get exploited, they foster peace.
The impulse to do that is very strong in the mainstream, the liberal side of the mainstream traditions.
Mm-hmm.
You're actually getting a reaction these days, and this is in Australia, it's in the UK, it's in the USA, of those who say, no, in doing that, you're actually sacrificing the core of who and what you are.
Yeah.
And there is a very strong conservative reaction that's not just in civil religion, in that populist religion, but exists in elements of all mainstream denominations at the moment.
Yeah.
There's almost a coherent feeling about this that is across it's the Anglicans, it's the in Australia, the Uniting Church, in America, the United Churches of Christ, all of those denominations are feeling it.
There's a tendency to fear that encountering the other and dialogue with the other erodes one's identity. The Muslim American social activist Eboo Patel, I think, addresses this really beautifully in his book Acts of Faith, where he articulates what I call a grounded pluralism. That is, the purpose of encounter and dialogue with others, which is possible in a pluralistic multicultural society, is not to convert, not to, you know, change the other, but is to, you know, to reason together, to come to a common word between us, as an extraordinary collection of Muslim theologians put it for us. So I understand that fear. Identity is a fragile thing. And I certainly realize how in the 20th century, as we've become aware of religious difference, identity can seem threatened.
Because our truth is threatened, or our exclusive hold on truth
that's
is threatened.
That's exactly right, John. And again, it's when we confuse our approximation of truth, our metaphors, our language, our articulations of truth with the whole truth, that we get into problems. And this is, again, where humility comes into play, and we realize our truth is stronger when it's formed through dialogue and collaboration and consensus than when it's merely the pronouncement from on high by one individual.
Is there a serious issue here at stake for major traditions, with fissures opening up internally? And you're even seeing established theologians like Thomas Oden, who's an Arminian tradition theologian, but writing books called Turning Around the Main Line, which is virtually an instruction manual on how to run a fifth column within churches to preserve the sort of coherent conservative center.
Yeah, well, I think that conservative center misunderstands the vitality of tradition. Jaroslav Pelikan, the great Lutheran historian of doctrine, said, you know, tradition is the living faith of the dead. Traditionalism is the dead faith of the living. And so when we forget that traditions thrive precisely by correcting themselves self-critically, by rationalizing, you know, mistakes that have happened in the past, by engaging in imaginative and charismatic renewal, we get into trouble. When we imagine that it's fixed, static, and, you know, once and for all done over, that's a problem.
John Paul, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, John. Thank you.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. You can download your favourite Sunday night interviews from our website at abc.net.au/sundaynights with an S. Thank you for listening.